the Heckler Koch was resting on the windowsill.
No, Vinny said. Let me.
The silence seemed to twist and tighten. The frozen immobility of the scene seemed to squeeze in upon itself as though it would eventually shatter. I felt as if the pit of my stomach were clenched like a fist. Fortunately, I was brave, clean, and reverent. Otherwise, I might have been a little scared.
"You got any preference?" I said to the preacher.
"This all the people you got?"
the preacher said.
"All we need at the moment," I said.
"You know a guy named Morris Tannenbaum?" The preacher just stared at me.
"Morris tells me you and he had a deal," I said. "But he's mad at you now and wants you gone."
No one moved. The preacher stared.
"Wants to pay us to get rid of you."
Hawk still pressed the muzzle of his .44 against Pony's forehead. I could hear Pony breathing.
"This guy Tannenbaum," the preacher said. "He tell you this himself?"
"Ronnie told us," I said.
The preacher thought about that.
"So what's your question?"
the preacher said.
"What was your deal with Tannenbaum?" The preacher thought about that. I was pretty sure he wasn't brave, clean, and reverent. But he didn't seem scared. In fact, he didn't seem anything. His pale eyes showed nothing that I could detect. His voice was without inflection. His body language revealed nothing. In fact, there was no body language. He sat motionless.
"Why should I tell you?" he said.
"Why not?" I said.
The preacher looked slightly amused, his face like one of those close-up photographs of rattlesnakes, where the snake seems almost mischievous.
"Why not?"
he said.
I waited, both of us ringed with weapons, both of us heated by the sun. Then the preacher made some sort of facial gesture, which was probably a smile.
"Why not?"
he said again.
"Tannenbaum wanted us to run people out of Potshot."
"Why?"
"He never said."
"What did you get?"
"I got a fee. And we got whatever we could squeeze out of the town."
"Why is the deal off?"
"Maybe you should ask him."
"I don't have him in the middle of the street with six weapons pointed at him."
"You think I'm talking 'cause I'm scared?"
The preacher's empty eyes held on me.
"No," I said.
He nodded slowly.
"We like what we got," the preacher said. "We can live off this town forever. We don't use it up."
"So you didn't want to drive people out?"
"Not till we got all there was."
"And Tannenbaum didn't like it."
"Fuck him,"
the preacher said. In the silence, I could hear my own breathing. I felt stiff with tension, but I held still. Everyone was probably as tight as I was. I didn't want to start the shooting. Carefully, I said, "Who killed Steve Buckman?"
"Don't know."
"You got any connection with Mrs. Buckman?"
The preacher made a cackling sound. It might have been a laugh.
"I'd like one," he said. "How about you, Pony? You like to make a connection with Mrs. Buckman?"
Pony was stock still with the muzzle of Hawk's gun still against his forehead. It was a big gun, a .44 Magnum with a stainless steel finish that made it glitter in the brutal sunshine. Neither of them had moved since the event began.
"Guess Pony ain't talking,"
the preacher said.
"Thanks for your help," I said. "Time to go."
"Maybe we don't think so,"
the preacher said.
"Maybe we don't care," I said. The preacher glanced slowly around at the circumstances. They were not to his advantage.
"Things start," the preacher said. "We kill you first."
"We'll go together," I said.
The preacher nodded, still assessing.
"We'll go,"
he said.
"Stay away from the town," I said. The preacher gave me another one of those amused rattlesnake stares. Then he nodded at the other men, and they got back in their vehicles. As they drove away, the muscles that had been so tight now became so loose I felt like I ought to lie down. Decompensating. The sound of the two vehicles faded. Sapp tossed his shotgun onto the back seat of his car and got in the driver's side. Bernard J. Fortunato got in with him. Cholo got in with Bobby Horse.
Vinny closed his hotel window and appeared a minute later with a rifle and a gun case. He got in with Cholo and Bobby Horse. The two cars pulled away. Hawk let the hammer down on his big stainless steel revolver and slid it back into its holster. He grinned at me.
"Cool," he said.
Chapter 53 The Rattlesnake Cafe served donuts. Hawk had four and coffee. I wasn't hungry yet. I had coffee.
"You know he ain't gonna let this go," Hawk said.
I nodded.
"Why, he told you all that stuff. 'Cause he going to kill you."
"And you," I said.
"And everybody else," Hawk said. "So he don't care what he says to you."
"Which means he probably told the truth."
"Probably," Hawk said.
"Which means maybe Steve Buckman wasn't killed by the Dell." Hawk broke a donut in half and took a significant bite.
"How about the Saguaro Development Corporation?"
"Why would they kill him?"
"I just a hired hard case," Hawk said. "You the sleuth."
"They seem to be players," I said.
"Anybody in Saguaro Development got the balls to do it?"
"Mary Lou," I said. Hawk nodded and finished his half donut. He took a sip of his coffee.
"Even though she cute and got a blonde ponytail?"
"That usually eliminates a suspect," I said. "But somebody killed Buckman." Dean Walker slipped into the booth next to me. He was looking clean and shiny. His uniform shirt was freshly pressed. He took his hat off and laid it crown down on the table in front of him.
"How are the donuts?" he said.
"No such thing as a bad donut," Hawk said.
He gestured at the waitress, and she brought him coffee without further instruction.
"Did you have a little incident this morning?" Walker said to me.
"Big incident," I said.
"Pretty good," he said.
"You witness any of it?" I said.
Walker smiled.
"They're not going to let it go," he said.
"Probably not."
"There's seven of you," Walker said.
"You counted."
"There's about 40 of them.
Preacher says he didn't shoot Steve Buckman."
"Preacher ain't the most honest guy," Walker said.
"Nor the nicest," I said.
"But what if he were telling the truth?"
"Then it must have been somebody else," Walker said.
"That's why you're chief of police," I said.
"Nothing like a trained professional," Walker said. "What are you going to do about the Dell?"
"Wait and watch," I said.
"You ought to leave," he said.
I shrugged.
"You won't," Walker said. "Will you?"
I shook my head. Hawk was on his last donut. He seemed to be paying no attention, which was, of course, a deception. Hawk paid attention to everything.
"Second best suggestion," Walker said. "Don't wait for them. Try to hit them first. I guarantee they're coming."
"Been urging that same course of action," Hawk said.
"You think Mary Lou might have killed her husband?"
"No."
"She might have," I said.
"No."
"Who's your candidate?" I said.
"If it wasn't the Dell?"
"Yeah."
"Might have been Ratliff."
"The producer?"
"Yeah, he followed her out here."
"Why?" Walker didn't answer. He took a sip of his coffee, shook his head slightly, and stirred more sugar into his cup.
"Unrequited love," I said. "He had an affair with her in L.A. Didn't mean anything. She and Steve were having a little trouble at the time."
"Last time I mentioned it," I said, "you said it was a lie."
"Did I say that?"
"You did."
"Probably before I learned the truth."
"Probably."
"He was annoying her," Walker said. "She complained to me, and I had a talk with him."
"What did he say?" Walker continued to stir his coffee. The gesture was automatic, as if he'd forgotten about it.
"He admitted he followed her out here, said he loved her, said he just wanted to be near her."
"And you think he killed Buckman to clear the way for himself?"
"Might have. Might have heard that the Dell threatened Steve and saw his chance. Shoot him, and the Dell gets blamed."
"It's a theory," I said.
"Yep."
"Mary Lou's part of a group that's buying up real estate," I said.
"Good for her."
"Where'd she get the money?"
"I look like H&R Block to you?"
"I'll take that to mean you don't know where she got the money."
"You take it to mean whatever the fuck you want to," Walker said.
The mayor's part of the group, I said, and J. George Taylor.
Yeah?
Why do you suppose they're doing that?
Real estate's cheap around here.
Because of the Dell?
Sure.
So why does this group want it?
Maybe they have confidence in you, Walker said.
Figure Potshot would boom without the Dell problem?
Walker shook his head.
Not enough water, he said. We're at capacity.
You ever sleep with Mary Lou, I said.
Hey, Walker said. Who the fuck do you think you're talking to?
Do you know who Morris Tannenbaum is?
You think she slept with him?
Do you?
Watch your mouth, pal. This is a lady you're talking about.
Nothing unladylike about getting laid, Hawk said.
Do you know Tannenbaum? I said.
No.
But you're worried that Mary Lou might have slept with him.
Walker stood up suddenly and picked up his hat and put it on.
Fuck this, he said, and left.
Touchy, Hawk said.
On this subject.
You think he might be right about Ratliff?
I think you're right about the question of ladies and sex.
Good to be right about something, Hawk said. You think she connected with Tannenbaum?
Everywhere I go in this thing, I keep bumping into either her or him, I said.
Don't mean they're connected, Hawk said.
Ever since I signed on for this, I've been trying to figure out where she's getting the money.
Tannenbaum got some, Hawk said.
He do, I said.
You got any ideas how to find out about him? Hawk said.
I do, I said.
Chapter 54. I sat on the front porch with my Winchester rifle leaning against the porch railing beside me and talked on the portable phone to Samuelson in L.A.
You got any surveillance on Tannenbaum, I said.
Me?
No.
Organized crime unit, maybe?
Don't know. Let me call you back.
I punched off and sat and looked at the angular desert plants for a while. Up the hill from the house, with a view of the road, Bobby Horse was taking his turn with one of the little black and yellow walkie-talkies we'd bought. In the house, Cholo had the other one. As Bernard J. Fortunato had explained, being murdered in our beds would suck. Peripherally, I saw a movement in the brush at the right corner of the house. I put down the cell phone and picked up the Winchester. A deer came delicately out from the cover, stopped short, and stared at me with its enormous dark eyes. I put the gun back down. The deer twitched its oversized ears a couple of times. I didn't move. After more staring and twitching, the deer ate a leaf off of one of the dry desert plants, then did a big leap into the woods and vanished. The portable phone rang. It was Samuelson.
OCU's got nothing going on with Tannenbaum, he said. But the feds do.
FBI?
Yep.
And?
And they are not sharing it with us.
Nice cooperation, I said. You got anybody who'll whisper it to you?
Maybe, but then I got to whisper stuff to him.
Okay, I said. I know a guy.
I was sure you would, Samuelson said, and broke the connection.
I went in the house and looked up a number in my address book, and came back out and sat and dialed it up. A man answered on the first ring.
Yes?
I said, Ives?
Who's calling?
Spencer. There was a pause while Ives processed me through his memory banks.
Well, he said, Lochinvar.
I need a favor, I said.
In which case, you will then owe me one.
There's a guy named Morris Tannenbaum, runs most of the rackets east of L.A.
Really, I've said.
The Bureau has surveillance on him, I said. I need to talk with someone who has access to it.
Our cousins at the Bureau are not usually forthcoming with surveillance data, I've said.
Give me a guy to talk with, I said.
I waited.
Wilbur, he said. Wilbur Harris.
I waited.
I'll call Wilbur. Give him a heads up on your behalf.
Got the phone number?
He gave it to me.
Call Wilbur in half an hour, I've said, and broke the connection.
Bernard J. Fortunato came onto the porch carrying a street sweeper.
Lot of firepower for a guy your size, I said.
50 rounds of 12-gauge shotgun shells, Bernard said. Automatic. Vinny showed me how to modify it.
he show you how to hit what you shoot at?" I said. "Already knew that," Bernard said. "I guess that thing makes accuracy less of an issue."
"You think I'm not accurate?" Bernard said. "I'm accurate."
"I hope so," I said. "I don't want you shooting one of us with that thing." I was watching the brush where the deer had silently moved. There was always some sort of muffled, visceral tug when I looked at a wild animal. I never really knew what the tug was, but I liked it when it happened.
"You sure they're gonna come?" Bernard said.
"They'll come."
"We backed them down pretty good in town," Bernard said.
"There's 40 of them and 7 of us," I said. "You think the preacher doesn't know that?"
"So?"
"So why fight us when the odds are even?"
"Then why don't we try what Bobby Horse says? Lock them up in the valley and shoot them from up above."
I shook my head.
"A lot of us think it's the way to go," Bernard said.
"I don't," I said.
"Maybe we should vote."
"Maybe I should make my phone call," I said.
Bernard shrugged and walked down to the other end of the porch. I called Wilbur Harris.
"I don't usually do this," Harris said, "but our mutual friend is entitled to a favor. You got surveillance on a guy in L.A. named Morris Tannenbaum?"
"No further mention of names, please," Harris said.
"We have him under consideration."
"Phone tap," I said.
"Yes."
"Visual surveillance?"
"Yes."
"Got a bug in the house?"
"Yes, in his study."
"How long?"
2 years."
"He make you?"
"I think he spotted the visual. They all assume they're tapped. I don't think he's wise to the bug."
"Can you give me the logs from the bug?"
"Sure," Harris said.
"Maybe do your tax returns for you?"
"And transcripts?"
"You can't have the transcripts. It would take too long to copy them."
"How about I give you a few names, and if you come across them, you send me their transcripts?"
"Give me the names. I'll see what we can do."
I gave him some names.
"If they're all in the logs, it's too many," he said. "We got a serious problem staffing clerical help."
"God forbid you do the Xeroxing yourself."
"God forbid."
"Can you overnight them to me?"
"And what do we get?" Harris said.
"I think Tannenbaum's tied to a big swindle," I said. "If I can bust my end of it, you might get Tannenbaum."
"Give me your address."
I did.
Chapter 55
Vinny was up on the hill with his walkie-talkie. The rest of us were on the porch. I sat on the railing. Hawk leaned on the post by the porch steps. Teddy Sapp was making drinks.
"We have a position," Cholo said. "For your consideration, jefe."
"We?"
"All of us, for whom I, a simple Latino, am honored to speak."
"That the same as simpleton?" I said.
"I do not think so. We are thinking that it makes no sense for us to sit here and wait for the Dell to attack us when we could go out and slyly shoot them while they were still in their hole."
"If we were to be successful, we'd have to massacre pretty much all of them," I said.
"Sí."
"I don't want to do that," I said.
"On the other hand, senor, we do not wish them to massacre us."
"I was thinking maybe there'd be a third option," I said. "Maybe I can bust this murder case, and then maybe we won't have to fight the Dell."
"We would run?"
"It's a third option," I said. Nobody else said anything. Cholo took the drink that Teddy Sapp handed him, and took a sip and held it happily in his mouth for a moment before he swallowed it.
"You are not so reticent about shooting in Proctor when we were after that cop's wife," Cholo said.
"We weren't shooting fish in a barrel."
"We were risking women and children."
"They were risking the women and children," I said. "We were getting Belson's wife out of there, and it was worth a massacre if it came to that."
"And this situation is not worth a massacre?"
"No." Cholo thought about that. Everyone else was quiet.
"You do not have to do it," Cholo said without anger. "We can do it, and when we have, you can solve your murder."
Sapp handed me some beer in a long-neck bottle. Blue Moon, a personal favorite. I had a pull. "No," I said. Cholo didn't seem offended. Thoughtfully, he rocked back in his chair. Bobby Horse sat beside him, both feet flat on the floor. Bernard was in another rocker,
the second walkie-talkie on the table beside him. Teddy Sapp had stopped tending bar and was leaning on the wall, his arms folded. Even in repose, Sapp looked as if he were flexing. Cholo balanced his chair by touching his feet to the floor just often enough to keep the chair steady. He looked at Hawk.
"I'm with him," Hawk said, and nodded toward me.
"You would have a problem with shooting them?" Cholo said.
"No."
"But you won't?"
"No."
Cholo nodded slowly. He looked at Bobby Horse.
"We could go back to L.A., Bobby Horse said.
"See?"
Cholo looked at Sapp.
"I vote for the massacre," Sapp said.
"Bernard?" Cholo said.
"I'd just as soon shoot all of them that we can," Bernard said.
Cholo turned back toward me.
"But I got something else," Bernard said.
Cholo waited, loose in his chair, peaceful.
"We ought to do what he says."
"Because?" Cholo asked.
"Because we said we would."
"And we cannot change our mind?"
"Bernard J. Fortunato's word is good," he said.
All of us were quiet, staring at Bernard. Finally, Teddy Sapp spoke.
"You're so fucking little," he said. "I didn't know you had a word."
"You gotta keep your word more," Bernard said, "if you're small."
Cholo was looking past me, toward the road.
"Hello, FedEx," he said.
A Federal Express truck pulled up in front of the house, and the driver got out with an envelope.
"Mr. Spencer," he said.
"Me," I said. He handed me the letter. I signed his little etch-a-sketch, and he went to his truck and drove away. I opened the envelope. Inside was a thick sheaf of computer printout. I slipped it back in the envelope and looked around the porch.
"You guys come to any conclusions?" I said.
"Bobby Horse and I will stay," Cholo said.
"Me too," Teddy Sapp said.
"Vinny told me he'd do what I did," Hawk said.
I looked around the porch. With the possible exception of Sapp, these were bad men who had done bad things.
"Okay," I said. No one had anything else to say.
"Why don't you read that list?" Hawk said.
Chapter 56. I read the transcripts first. There were three. One George, who seemed to be a drug dealer, one Henry, who sounded like a bookie, and one Lou, female, talking about water resources in a place called Potshot, no state mentioned. The entry was dated a month before she hired me. Some of it was the kind of trivial chatter that people have before they settle in. Then I came to it.
Tannenbaum.
"Fix us a couple more drinks, will you, baby?"
Lou.
"I'd love to."
Tannenbaum.
"Oh, man, that hits the spot."
Lou.
"To you, Maury."
Tannenbaum.
"Preacher's fucking us. I think he knows about the water."
Lou.
"Steve told him."
Tannenbaum.
"That fucking blow. He's like a loose fucking cannon, bragging about being a bad guy. He's gonna fuck up this fucking deal if we don't do something about him."
"I told you we needed to do something about him."
Lou. "I can fix it."
Tannenbaum.
"How you gonna fix it?"
Lou.
"I know a person who will do it."
Tannenbaum.
"I don't want you hiring nobody. A lot of deals go south because some fucking hired guy can't keep his fucking mouth shut."
Lou.
"Person I'm thinking of will be fine. He'll do anything I say."
Tannenbaum.
"You fucking him?"
Lou.
"Just enough."
Tannenbaum.
"To keep him under control?"
Lou.
"Uh-huh."
Tannenbaum.
"That what you're doing to me?"
Lou.
"Nobody can keep you under control, Maury."
Sound of sexual activity. Tannenbaum.
"Come on, you little bitch. You know you want it."
Lou.
"Maury, I'm not gonna fuck you right here on the floor."
Tannenbaum.
"You'd fuck me in the middle of the I-5 freeway if you needed to."
Lou.
"Come on, Maury. Let's go to bed."
It was pretty clear that they were talking about Steve Buckman's impending murder, though no one quite said it. And the feds were willing to let some guy named Steve get fixed rather than reveal their bug on Tannenbaum. I knew they'd say, "If we can put Tannenbaum out of business,
will save a lot more lives than maybe this guy Steve, who may get killed. And I knew they were probably right. The most good for the most people and all that. I was glad I didn't have to think that way. I thought about Lou with Morris Tannenbaum and felt crawly. Then I found myself smiling, alone, in the badly furnished living room of a rented house in a remote town. I had a genuine clue implicating my client in her husband's murder, and my first reaction was disappointment in her sex life. Then I wondered who the someone was that would do anything she told him. I knew of two guys in Potshot that she might control, Mark Ratliff and Dean Walker. Given what I was learning about Mary Lou, there might have been 20 others. Anyone who would bop Morris Tannenbaum. And I kind of liked Walker. I hoped it wasn't him. I went through the logs looking for familiar names. There were none. If anyone else from Potshot was talking to Morris Tannenbaum, it wasn't someone I knew. Chapter 57. Vicky was doing turquoise today. Turquoise sundress and a turquoise headband restraining her dark hair. Her long fingernails were turquoise, and she wore a heavy turquoise and silver necklace with matching earrings.
"Mr. Ratliff isn't in," she said, after she'd admired the way I walked to her reception desk.
"When do you expect him?"
"I don't know," she said. He hasn't been in all week."
"Have you talked with him?"
"I called his home. I was worried. All I got was his machine."
"On which you left a message?"
"Several," she said.
"And no call back?"
"No."
"You report him missing?"
"I called Chief Walker," she said. "He said that he was sure nothing untoward had happened."
"Untoward?"
"That's the word he used," Vicky said.
"I love a good vocabulary," I said. "Don't you?"
"Of course."
Walker's words must have comforted Vicky. She didn't seem consumed with worry. She was still looking at me like an appraiser. I wondered if the look was lustful. I sucked in my stomach. "Give me his home address," I said. "I'll go check on him."
"I don't know if I should," Vicky said.
"Of course you should."
"You are a detective," she said.
"You bet I am." She appraised me some more. It seemed a cool appraisal, but it might have masked lust. I smiled reassuringly. Big smile. Wide, friendly, honest. You can count on me. She smiled back and wrote Ratliff's home address on the back of a business card and handed me the card. I must use that smile only for good. Mark Ratliff's house was small and stuccoed in faux Spanish, with red tile on the roof. A BMW sports car was parked under a carport to the right of the house. Several days' worth of the Los Angeles Times were scattered near the front door. I looked at them. The earliest was last Tuesday. The most recent was this morning. I rang the bell. No one answered. I walked around the house. There was a small patio out back and a sliding door that opened onto it. The locks on sliding doors often worked badly. I tried the door. It didn't open. I looked inside. The door was held in place by a short stick that prevented it from sliding. Sticks worked well. I walked around the house again. No alarm signs. No "protected by" stickers in the windows. I went back to the patio, took my gun out, and broke the glass in the sliding door enough so I could reach in and remove the stick. Then I slid the door open and went in. It was cool. The air conditioning made a quiet sound. Everything else was still. The house was empty. I would look carefully, but you almost always know when a house is empty as soon as you walk in. The house was orderly but not anal. Beside a Barca lounger in the living room was a copy of the Los Angeles Times dated last Monday. It was scattered on the floor, the way it would be if someone had been reading it. On the floor next to the right side of the Barca lounger, among the newspaper pages, was a squat glass with a half inch of water in it. I picked it up and sniffed. Scotch, maybe. The ice had melted. I walked through the house. All seemed to be in order. In Ratliff's bedroom were three pieces of matched luggage of descending sizes. Lined up, side by side, they just fit the width in the back of his closet. In the linen closet was a tan pigskin shaving kit. It was empty. There were sunglasses, some keys, and loose change on top of the bureau in his bedroom. There was a toothbrush in the slot in his bathroom. An electric shaver sat in its recharging base on a glass shelf under the mirror. In the kitchen there was milk in the stainless steel refrigerator. I smelled it. Spoiled. The refrigerator reminded me of Susan's. There wasn't much in there. Producers are probably too important to cook, unlike Susan, who was too impatient. Ratliff had converted what was probably once a dining room into a den. There was an imposing desk in front of the back window. I looked through it and found nothing much beyond some bills, a couple dozen Bic pens, and a roll of Tums. I punched up his answering machine. There were two calls from Vicky and no others. I picked up his phone. Dial tone. I browsed his computer. There was an online banking folder, a stationery folder, and a screenplay folder. I opened it. There was a 135-page screenplay titled The Millennium Beast. The title page said it was by Mark Ratliff. The format was very professional. I read a couple of pages. It was horrendous. Ratliff probably had a hit on his hands. It took me another couple of hours to go through everything in the house. When I finished, I went back into his living room and sat on the couch. All I knew for sure was that Ratliff wasn't there. His luggage seemed intact. He hadn't taken his shaving kit. His toothbrush was still in the bathroom, and so was his electric razor. He might have had another piece of luggage. He might have another home fully stocked with razors and toothbrushes. But his car was still in the carport. His keys were still on his bureau. Ratliff appeared to have left without taking anything, by means unknown, for reasons unknown. At least, unknown to me. Chapter 58. It was just after sunrise. We were at breakfast, like our ancestors. No television, no nightlife. We went to bed early and got up early. Bernard had cooked up hash and eggs. Sap was already on his third coffee. "When you think the Dell will come?" Sap said. He didn't sound apprehensive. He seemed simply curious. "They come before we're through solving his murder," Hawk said. "We got something to think about. There are about 40 of them and about 7 of us." "Which is about 6 to 1," I said. "I'd have never figured that out," Hawk said. "Is it a genetic thing?" I said. "Yeah, we good at tap dancing, though." "I figure we need to find a way to make it more even," I said. "Try to force them to split up?" "Something like that. So we can end up, say, 7-on-6, our favor?"
"I've been thinking the same thing," Cholo said. "Except for the numbers. We no good at numbers, either."
"So what are you good at?" I said.
"Playing the guitar, singing sad songs."
"Just what we need."
"See."
"That's what the cavalry is for," Sap said.
"Cavalry," Bernard said from the stove. "I can't ride no fucking horse."
"Get you a pony," Sap said. He looked at me. "You get what I mean?" "Yes," I said. "Bring a lot of force to bear on a small section of the enemy by moving a small force around rapidly." Sap shot me with his forefinger and thumb. He nodded several times.
"Mobility," he said. "That what you meant? Why'd you say so?" Bernard said. "'Stead of that pony shit." "Who we got for cavalry?" Vinny said. "Us," Cholo said.
"So," Hawk said, "we don't figure out what to do with them. We figure out what to do with us."
I put some more ketchup on the hash. You can't have too much ketchup on hash. I ate some and had a bite of toast and a swallow of coffee. Balance is important. I didn't say anything. One of the things I'd learned from Susan was the creative use of silence.
"How about you, Kimosabi?" Cholo said to Bobby Horse. "You got any Kiowa battle secrets?"
"Get them to circle the wagons," Bobby Horse said, "and ride around and around them."
"I got firing points laid out," Vinny said, "so the field of fire covers all the approaches to the house."
"But we stay in the house, we still back to 6-on-1, Hawk said. Vinny nodded. My breakfast wasn't coming out even. I took another piece of toast from the platter Bernard had put on the table.
So we need to get out of the house, Cholo said.
We probably in better shape than they are, Hawk said. We get higher than them, they're going to be laboring, they have to chase us uphill.
Especially, I said, if they have to chase us a lot. Chapter 59 I was alone on the front porch when Dean Walker pulled his cruiser up in front of the house. Hatless, he got out and came up the front walk, his eyes masked behind his aviator shades. "Holding the fort," he said.
"Valiantly," I said.
"You still got troops?"
"Yep."
"Handy?"
"Yep."
"Good," Walker said. "You'll need them."
"Because?"
"Because today's the day," Walker said.
"For?"
"For the Dell to come down on you."
"How many?"
"All of them."
"When?"
Walker smiled. "Can't say for sure," he said, "but they aren't early risers."
"But you know it's today."
"Yeah."
"How would you know that?" I said.
"I'm the police," Walker said.
"And where do you stand?" I said.
"Out of the way," Walker said.
"So why'd you warn me?"
"Civic duty," Walker said.
I nodded. We looked at each other for a moment. Then Walker turned and walked back to his car and got in and drove off. I watched him go. Then I picked up my Winchester and walked up the hill behind the house. The desert was empty, sprawled in harsh metallic silence under the oppressive sun. Bobby Horse was on lookout with binoculars around his neck and his BAR leaning in the shade of a rock.
"Where's Hawk?" I said.
"Down near the road. They're running things through."
I said, "The Dell's on its way." Bobby Horse scanned the landscape with his binoculars.
"Don't see them," he said.
I picked up the walkie-talkie from the shade beside the BAR.
"Hawk," I said.
He answered. "Bring everyone back up to the lookout," I said. "Dell's coming."
"'Bout time," Hawk said.
After Bobby Horse spots them with the glasses, I said, when we were gathered, "it'll take them about 15 minutes to arrive."
"What if they come another way?" Bernard said.
"There isn't another way," I said, "except over the mountain behind us. They're not that industrious."
Hawk nodded.
"We put Vinny on the right, Cholo in the center, and Bernard Huzis on the left."
"Fortunato," Bernard said. "God damn it, Bernard J. Fortunato."
"Right," Hawk said. "You on the left. Me and Sap and Bobby Horse start in the center, behind Cholo, and bust our ass left or right, depending on what's going down."
"Like in Zulu," Sap said.
"That's where I learned all my military tactics," Hawk said.
"Spencer?"
"I'll freelance," I said.
"I sort of guessed that," Hawk said.
"We already have water and ammunition stashed at each firing position."
He had forgotten his jive accent again.
"Drink a lot of water," I said.
"That way," Cholo said, "we run out of ammunition. We can piss on them."
"What you gonna do freelancing?" Vinny said.
"I thought I'd hide under the bed until you guys won," I said.
"We'll let you know," Vinny said.
"But in case I'm not under the bed," I said, "I'll be down below the house, behind them, if they come in."
"And?" Sap said.
"And I want to be the first one to shoot."
"If possible," Hawk said.
"If possible." I turned and started down the hill. After 10 steps, I turned and said to Hawk, "Good hunting." To my ear, I sounded amazingly like Stuart Granger. Hawk grinned and gave me a thumbs up.
"Gringos watch too many movies," Cholo said.
"African-Americans, too," Hawk said.
"See?"
I went on down the hill.
Chapter 60 They came in a long, relentless line of trucks and motorcycles. As they moved past me onto the dirt road to the house, dust lingered behind them, kicked up by their passage. Mongol hordes. I lay behind my rock in a clump of cactus as they passed, with the sun pressing down on my back and the Winchester laid across the rock. I had a bag of ammunition and some water. I wore a Browning 9mm on my right hip, and the Smith & Wesson 38 butt forward on my left side. The line pulled up in front of the house and spread into a wide semicircle, the motors still running. The thick smell of exhaust fouled the intense desert air.
They were so used to intimidating people, and they had arrived in such numbers that they were arrogant, and arrogance made them stupid. They put out no scouts and paid no attention to the possibility of ambush. Their only concession to the possibility that we might put up a fight was to dismount their vehicles and stay behind them, except the preacher. He sat upright and almost regal in the passenger seat beside the Mexican driver, while Pony threw a leg over the side and climbed out of the back seat of the scout and waddled fearsomely to the front door, carrying an assault rifle. The collective motors grumbled in the silence.
"Spencer," Pony said loudly.
Nothing.
"Preacher's here," Pony said.
Nothing. The preacher gestured, and 9 men moved out from behind the vehicles and clustered behind Pony. All of them had long guns.
"You come out, or we come in," Pony blared.
We didn't come out. Pony jacked the shell up into the chamber of the assault rifle, kicked open the door, and went in. The other 9 guys crowded in behind them, bumping into each other and jamming up in the door before they got through. It didn't appear that they'd given this a lot of planning. In 3 or 4 minutes they came back out, this time taking turns through the door.
"Looks like they run," Pony said.
The preacher began to look up the hill.
"They didn't run far," he said. "Spread out. Look for them."
I levered around into the chamber of the Winchester. The Mexican driver heard the sound and jumped from the scout with a long-barreled revolver in his hand and a half-crouch, looking toward my rock. I eased the rifle over the rock, aiming so that the Mexican driver was sitting on my front sight. He saw the movement and snapped off a shot that spanged off the rock. I shot him in the middle of the chest, and he fell straight backward and lay on the ground beside the scout. The remainder of the dell surged toward my rock, and my colleagues opened up from the hillside. The preacher sat bolt upright in the scout.
"Pony," he said, "take 5 men and clean up behind the rock. The rest of you spread out up the hill. Don't bunch up."
With my ammo and my water, I moved down from behind my rock and crossed the road behind them and took new shelter in a small wash behind the house. The gunfire from the hill badly damaged the center of the dell advance. Stalled, the survivors pinned down behind whatever cover they could find. I could hear the fast boom-boom of Bernard's street sweeper. Then the firing stopped. The silence was startling. From the wash, I could see Pony and his team moving carefully up behind the rock where I had been. From the hillside, the gunfire erupted again, and the right flank of the dell line washed back and hunkered down. But the left flank surged forward, as if responding to the ebbing of the right, and now their gunfire was on the top of the hill. From behind my former rock, I heard Pony yell to the preacher,
"He's not here!"
"Then get your asses up the hill," the preacher said.
The gunfire was dense, and almost entirely from the left. My guys must have clustered up on that flank. The dell line in the center began to move again, and the right side surged back as if having reached low tide. It was making its natural rebound. There were too many of them. We were in danger of getting overrun. I squirmed along the wash and scuttled, bent nearly double, up the hillside on the right. 20 yards behind the advancing dell troops, I took up residence behind another rock and began to snipe the advance. I knocked 2 of them down before they realized where I was shooting from. I saw 4 of them peel off and head cautiously back down the hillside, looking for me. I had a map of the area in my head. I'd walked it days ago. I knew where every rock was, every depression in the ground, every growth of arid vegetation sufficient to hide behind. I picked off 1 of the people looking for me and dove and rolled into a little gully with a fringe of brush along the lip. Gunfire scattered around the rock. The smell of it hung heavy in the stifling air. My eardrums hurt. From the other side of the line, behind the advancing left flank of the dell forces, I heard the crack of a rifle, close enough to me to be sharp against the general din of arms. Somebody had gotten behind the dell lines on the left and was picking them off from behind as I was on the right. It was as if everything were balanced precisely until the second sniper showed up. He was too much. The balance teetered.
The Del Assault held for a moment, hanging on to the top of the hill, and then broke. These were not professionals. It started as a hesitation, then a halt, then a withdrawal, and, as the withdrawal moved back down the hill, it picked up speed and turned very quickly into a running away. Two guys ran right past me as I lay in my gully. They were intent on leaving. They paid no attention to me. I didn't shoot them. I stood and ran through the route, weaving among the running men like a kick returner. I was looking for the preacher. I found him standing stiffly upright beside the jeep as his troops flowed past him. He was making no attempt to stop the route. He seemed frozen by it. I stopped beside him, holding the Winchester muzzle down but cocked. "Now you know how Custer felt," I said. The preacher turned his head and stared at me. He didn't say anything. The retreat tumbled past us, and then it was gone. My ears rang from the firing. The smell of the gunfire was everywhere. My shirt was soaked with sweat and clung to my back. I could hear my breath heaving in and out. Up the hill there was movement. My side. The first person I saw was Teddy Sapp. He was shirtless, carrying Bernard J. Fortunato in his arms, as if Bernard weighed no more than a puppy. Bernard's right pant leg was wet with blood, and a piece of shirt, presumably Teddy Sapp's, was tied around his thigh. Hawk was behind him, one arm around Bobby Horse, who leaned on him heavily as they edged down. Vinny came behind them with Cholo. Cholo was bleeding on one side of his neck. "They shot me," Bernard said, as they came up to where I stood. "Fuckers shot me right in the goddamn leg. In the fucking leg. Hurts like a bastard."
"Great shooter," Sapp said. "Hit a target as small as you."
"Bobby," I said.
"Tore up my left knee," he said.
Cholo stood in front of the preacher for a moment and then grinned at him. He said,
"We deal in lead, friend."
The preacher showed no sign that he'd heard Cholo or that he knew we were there. He was still rigid beside the ratty scout. Teddy Sapp put Bernard down in the shade of the scout and let him lean on the front right tire. Hawk helped Bobby Horse onto the ground beside him. Bobby didn't lean. He lay flat on his back and stared straight into the pain. I looked at my watch. The whole fight had taken 20 minutes.
"What about your neck?" Vinny said. "A piece of rock," Cholo said. "Chipped off and nicked me."
There was movement on the left periphery. Five of us turned to shoot, and Dean Walker came out of the scrub where not so long ago the deer had walked, carrying an AR-15 and looking a little sweaty. His radio was strapped to his belt, the microphone clipped to one of his shoulder epaulets. "I already called for some EMTs," he said. He spoke to the preacher.
"You're under arrest," he said, "for assault with deadly force, for trespassing, and probably for leading an insurrection. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right to an attorney."
From out of sight, faintly at first, down the road toward town, I could hear the whoop of the ambulance siren growing louder. Chapter 61. Showered and shaved, comforted by 10 hours sleep behind me and 6 buckwheat cakes, I sat in Dean Walker's office drinking coffee from a white mug that said Santa Monica on it in red script. He drank from one just like it.
"Been a cop too long," Walker said. "I couldn't let it slide."
"Good," I said. "How about the Dell?"
"Most of them have split," Walker said. "I managed to convince the county that the ones left were squatting on county land, and there's a bunch of sheriff's deputies up there now evicting them."
"Also good," I said. "How about your cops?"
"They resigned," Walker said.
"Didn't care to fight the Dell?"
"Not at these prices," Walker said.
My coffee was gone. I went over to the Mr. Coffee on the top of the file and poured another cup. I brought it back and sat down again across from Walker.
"I wish I owned a swell cup like this," I said.
"I know," Walker said. "I feel very lucky."
"Preacher got anything to say?"
"Not yet."
"He will," I said, "when it's time to save his ass."
Walker smiled.
"How cynical," he said.
"I'm trying to change," I said.
"Never too late," he said. "Collie Dark's coming down to talk to the preacher about Steve Buckman."
"I don't think the preacher did it," I said.
He did something, Walker said.
I don't want to bag him for something he didn't do, I said.
I'll take what I can get, Walker said.
We were quiet. We drank some coffee in the cool, empty room. Mr. Coffee had done a nice job. The coffee was good.
What about Mark Ratliff, I said.
I don't got Mark Ratliff in a cell, Walker said. I got the preacher.
And you're willing to railroad him?
The preacher's a creep, Walker said. He was out to kill you. He's probably killed a lot of people. Just because maybe he didn't kill Stevie Buckman is no reason not to hang him for it.
How cynical, I said.
I'm trying to change, Walker said, and smiled. We drank some more coffee. The hushed sound of the air conditioning made the room seem even quieter than it would have with no sound at all.
Ratliff's missing, I said.
That's what his secretary says.
You've been looking for him?
I'm a one-man department, Walker said. I've been kind of busy.
I owe you for that time in the street, I said, and I owe you more for showing up when you did yesterday.
Walker nodded and said nothing.
But I don't owe you everything there is.
You don't owe me nothing, Walker said. I was doing what I'm supposed to do.
And now you're not. I came out here to find out who killed Steve Buckman, not just clear the case.
Walker was silent. Then he said, I think maybe it's time you went home.
Not yet, I said.
Whatever you might think, Walker said, I'm what this place has got for law. I could shoot you dead for resisting arrest and no one would say shit.
Someone might, I said.
Walker smiled again, but not because he was happy.
You're an optimistic bastard, he said.
I finished my coffee and put the empty mug down on the edge of Walker's desk and stood up.
Persistent, too, I said.
Chapter 62. It was our last breakfast together. We were eating omelets with onions made, and beautifully, by me. Everyone was at the table in the kitchen except Bobby Horse, who was propped up on a couch that Cholo and Hawk had dragged in from the living room. A local doctor had done what he could for Bobby Horse, put a cast on the knee, and had given him a large supply of Percocet. The Percocet made him quieter, which I would have thought impossible. Bernard J. Fortunato wasn't as badly hurt. The bullet had gone through his thigh without breaking any bone. It had destroyed some of the tissue around the entry hole, and it would take a while to heal. Bernard had Percocet, too, and its effect was to make him more talkative. Between him and Bobby Horse, they averaged out about normal.
"So what I want to know," Bernard said, sitting sideways at the table with his injured legs sticking out toward the stove, "didn't we ambush those Dell guys and shoot them up pretty good?"
"We did," I said. I put an omelet on a plate with some biscuits. Cholo took it to Bobby Horse.
"You need me to feed you?" Cholo said.
Bobby Horse shook his head.
"So if we was going to ambush the fuckers anyway," Bernard said, "how come we didn't do it first? Climb up there and shoot them down right in the canyon?"
"They hadn't come for us then," I said.
"That's why I got fucking shot," Bernard said.
I nodded. I was at the stove again making another omelet. You have to make omelets in small batches or they don't work, and the pan needs to be cured, and the heat needs to be right. You don't just break a bunch of eggs.
I don't get it, Bernard said.
You get used to it, Vinny said.
But we did the same fucking thing, Bernard said, and I got fucking shot doing it, and so did Bobby Horse.
The current omelet had firmed up just enough. I folded it over, shook it around in the pan a minute, and slid it onto a plate. I gave it to Bernard.
Are you going to explain it? Bernard said to me.
Just eggs and some pan-fried onions, I said.
I'm not talking about the fucking omelet, for Christ's sake, Bernard said. Vinny, you know what I'm talking about?
Vinny shrugged.
You get it? Bernard said to Vinny.
Yeah.
And?
You get used to it,
Vinny said.
Well, it's fucking crazy, Bernard said.
Hawk put his coffee cup down and rested his forearms on the table.
No, he said. It's not crazy.
Bernard looked a little scared. Most people were afraid of Hawk, but there was a heft in Hawk's voice that Bernard had never heard before. A lot of people hadn't.
It's what makes him different than you, Hawk said. Or me, or Vinny, or Cholo, or Bobby Horse.
What about Teddy? Bernard said.
Bernard had the attention span of a hummingbird.
Don't know about Teddy, Hawk said. Might be more like Spencer.
Except for the queer part, Sap said.
Sip that, Hawk said. The rest of us, we see something that needs to be done. We do it. We don't much care how we do it. Spencer thinks that how you do it is as important as what you do.
I realized what had startled Bernard. There was no mockery in Hawk's voice. None of his usual up-alley, self-amused ghetto bebop. Bernard stared at him. They all did, except me. I was working on a new omelet.
Why? Bernard said.
Hawk grinned suddenly.
So he be different than us.
I don't think Bernard got it, but everyone else seemed to. And Bernard, Percocet-addled though he was, sensed it and shut up. The rest of breakfast conversation was devoted to women we had known. After breakfast, I sat on the front porch with Hawk and drank more coffee.
I don't need to sleep at night anyway, I said.
Cholo came out helping Bobby Horse. He got him arranged in the back seat of the car with one leg out straight and came back up the steps.
You got everything, I said? Guns are in the trunk, Jefe.
What about Bobby Horse, I said.
Mr. Del Rio has a friend at UCLA Medical Center, Cholo said.
I didn't know Del Rio had friends.
When he needs them, Cholo said. Like you.
I put out my right hand, clenched in a fist. Cholo tapped his fist lightly on top of it, nodded at Hawk, and walked to the car. Bobby Horse never glanced back as they drove away.
We through here? Hawk said.
Everybody but me, I said. Vinny came out with Teddy Sapp. Bernard J. Fortunato hobbled along with them. Teddy had an arm around him, holding him up. Bernard had one arm around Sapp's shoulder.
We're going to Vegas, Bernard said. I'm going to drink 6 Mai Tais and fuck 6 women the first day.
Better do it the other way around, I said.
I'll take the rental, Sapp said. Drop Bernard off. Turn it in at the airport. Fly home from Vegas.
My best to the ophthalmologist, I said.
Sapp grinned.
And to the shrink, Sapp said. The three of them headed for the car and got Bernard in the back. Sapp got in the driver's side. Vinny went around to the passenger side. He stopped before he got in and looked over the roof of the car.
I left my guns all packed, Vinny said. Drive them home for me.
You're going to Vegas, I said.
One drive between Boston and here is enough, Vinny said. Gonna help Bernard with the Mai Tais and the broads, then I'll fly home.
Viva Las Vegas, I said.
You gonna pay me?
When I get back to Boston. Vinny nodded.
I packed my guns in the back of the Explorer, he said. I'll pick them up in Boston.
Spencer's long haul, I said. No package, too illegal. Vinny nodded at Hawk and at me and slid into the car, and the car slid into gear and went down the road.
You still worrying about the guy got killed?
Steve Buckman.
Gonna stick around till you sort that out, Hawk said.
Yes. Hawk had his feet up on the railing, his hands locked behind his head, and his chair tilted back. He looked out at the sage and cactus and shale and sand that stretched in front of the house up the hill.
Me too, he said.
Chapter 63. Are you okay? Susan said when I called her.
I'm fine, I said. Just wanted to listen to your voice for a little while.
It'll have to be a very little while. I have another patient in 3 minutes.
Maybe he'll be late, I said.
He's never late. When are you coming home?
Not quite yet. I got everything done but one thing.
Have you done your thing with Adele yet?
Yep.
Successful?
Yep.
I was scared about that, Susan said.
Me too.
What's the one thing?
Who killed Steve Buckman?
Will it take long?
It shouldn't. I'm pretty sure I know who did it, and I'm pretty sure I can't prove it.
But you'll try, Susan said.
One last time, I said.
Then you'll come home.
Yes.
There was silence on the phone line for a while. When Susan spoke,
Her voice had deepened somehow and become richer.
"And what's the second thing you'll want when you get here?" she said.
I was quiet for a while, lying on the bed, looking up at the unaccommodating ceiling of the house where I'd spent too much time already.
"There is no